Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
There was an it bag a few years ago, an accessory that the hip and trendy were so eager to be seen carrying that some people bought three identical ones. It wasn't a designer purse, though, but a cotton tote bag sold at Whole Foods, printed with the words, "I am not a plastic bag." This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. The message behind those cheeky cotton bags is that disposable plastic bags are horrible for the environment and tacky to boot. But as so often happens with these things, the facts behind the story are more complicated. Plastic bags do require resources to produce, and they do create waste. But as my guest discovered, they hold up better than you might imagine against a lot of the reusable substitutes we've been buying to replace them. Catherine Mangue Ward is managing editor of Reason magazine. Her article, "Plastic Bags Are Good for You," is the cover story in the October issue. Catherine, welcome back to Think.
Thank you for having me.
What made you want to write a defense of the plastic bag?
You know, I'm always tempted to try and defend the indefensible. And I think this is a great example where, you know, on first glance, it's sort of an obvious thing. Oh, you know, these plastic bags, you use them, you throw them away. It's sort of the classic example of our consumerist society just, you know, thoughtlessly using resources. But I'd seen a little bit of pushback on that, not least from one of my colleagues at the Reason Foundation. I work for Reason Magazine, which that foundation publishes, who said, you know, let's think again. And so I started looking into it and found plastic bags do not deserve the bad rap that they get.
You start the piece with a reminder of how thin and light and strong they are.
Right. So this is something that I think we often overlook, the sort of technical miracles that surround us every day, not to sound too cheesy, but plastic bags are amazing. They are thinner than a strand of hair or a coat of paint or, and this is one that's sort of amazing and also disgusting, a human cornea. And yet they can hold 1,000 times their own weight. You can put, you know, a gallon of milk in this thing, and it's made of essentially a little whisper of plastic and some air. So I think the first thing to establish is just that the people who invented this technology sort of deserve kudos for having come up with this remarkable thing, and in fact did win a Nobel Prize for it.
So they're made of this stuff called polyethylene. What exactly is polyethylene?
Right. So high density polyethylene is, it's just a precipitate that comes out of a certain kind of a reaction. And it was discovered, as so many things are, semi-accidentally when chemists were just poking around trying to sort of see what they would find when they combined, in this case, I think, methane and ether. It was actually discovered several times over the course of many years, starting in 1989, in 1898. And for a long time, people didn't know what to do with it. Eventually, we get to a Swedish company called Cellaplast, where one of the chemists there not only figured out how to turn it into long, thin tubes, but also how to punch holes in the side, giving us the plastic bags that we know today.
All right, I want to step back and look at how we arrived at a moment when plastic bags were suddenly ubiquitous. I grew up with, full disclosure, I'm old enough to have grown up with paper bags, and I remember the conversion moment. How did people, long before that, do their food shopping when nobody handed you anything when you went and bought something?
Right. So the sort of notion that we would be so wealthy in packing materials that they would be given away by your retailer is relatively new. A long time ago, if you wanted to buy something that you wanted to take home with you, you were essentially on your own. You know, you bring a basket or, you know, a wagon if it was large. And if it was something that was messy, people tended to bring with them pieces of canvas, sometimes waxed canvas or leather, to wrap their goods. Now, needless to say, the paper bag was a pretty amazing improvement on, you know, going to the butcher and wrapping whatever he handed you in a dirty piece of cloth, not least for hygiene reasons, since, of course, we're not talking about a time when everyone had a washing machine in their house, so that piece of cloth certainly did not get washed very often. A woman actually invented the first automated paper bag machine, and she was one of the first women actually to be awarded with a patent for that kind of an invention.
She had to fight for it, though.
She did. There was an astonishing amount of controversy even then around bags, in this case around whether or not she had truly invented this automated paper bag making machine, and also whether or not whether or not such a patent could be given to a woman.
So paper bags were great. They worked well for a very long time. They are still in existence and they still serve their function. How did it happen that the polyethylene bag came along and sort of instantly knocked out the category or certainly brushed it aside, the category of paper grocery bags?
So, I mean, you, as you say, remember this moment when suddenly it was not only a question that was out there, but also kind of a punchline right away.
Paper or plastic? Right.
Like, it's as if it's this sort of, you know, unanswerable question somehow. So the reason that question starts being asked by grocers is there's actually someone has pinpointed the exact moment when plastic bags became a thing. In 1985, there was a gathering of, and this sounds like a really cool party, I have to say, the New Materials and Profits in Grocery Sacks and Co-Extrusions Conference at a Holiday Inn in Somerset, New Jersey.
They party hard.
And yeah, oh yeah. I mean, the happy hours at those things. So at this event, one of the companies that were making these new kinds of plastic bags, they showed up and they presented and they said, listen, they're 11.5% cheaper than paper. They're smaller. They're easier to stock. Boom. That's it. In 1983, virtually no one is stocking plastic bags in grocery stores, something like 10% of stores. By 1985, it's 75%.
Wow. And lots of people, when asked paper or plastic, initially chose paper, assuming it was the better environmental choice. The contest, though, is surprisingly close, and it matters what you're scoring.
Right. So this is really the beginning of this sense of small day-to-day decisions having import for environmental reasons. Although at first, the fast adopters of plastic bags versus the paper holdouts was actually an urban versus suburban distinction. So urban shoppers who had to carry their groceries home while walking, by and large, liked the fact that they could carry more than two bags at a time, that the plastic bags were actually less likely to rip. Whereas suburban shoppers like to line up their flat bottom paper bags in the back of their cars. So as always, the sort of urban versus suburban conflict presents itself very quickly here. But moreover, there was this sense of what it meant to be an environmentalist, which was shifting in the 80s. Forest conservation was a big deal in the 80s, which meant that perhaps people had become more skeptical of using paper, and recycling was not yet as completely universally available as it is now. At the same time, people were also concerned about using fossil fuels, although not yet really in the context of global warming. So, you know, that's when you start to get this sort of paper versus plastic. You know, people want to do the right thing, but they also sort of feel this sense of having to throw up their hands because the math has already gotten too complicated.
Was there instantly a backlash against plastic? Were people automatically thinking these things must be bad?
You know, I actually don't know. I wouldn't say I came across clear evidence one way or the other in my research. I think that people were skeptical in the same way that they are always skeptical of something new. And because environmentalism, sort of modern American environmentalism and conservationism, was already in the air, you know, the plastic bags did come in for some inquiry. But it really isn't until much later, more like the early aughts, that people start to feel the need to take action.
As I know you're aware, because you write about it in the piece, City of Dallas had a brief ban on plastic bags. Didn't last long. But the ban was in part due to all the trash that they generate. What did you learn about how much plastic bags contribute to what is called visible litter on the landscape?
So there is, as I learned when researching this article, a gold standard litter study in America. It's called the Keep America Beautiful Study. It's done by Steven Stein. And it's the iteration, which I think is the most recent iteration, in 2009. One of the things that they do is look at, okay, well, what is litter really made of? And there's a sort of term of art, which is visible litter, but it's what laymen think of as litter, the trash you see around. And what he found was that plastic bags make up 0.6% of visible litter and a little bit less than 1% of the total litter in storm drains. So it's sort of an interesting question, actually. Why is it, if plastic bags are such a small percentage of the litter, that they became the target for this campaign and that people have a really outsized idea? I think if you ask the man on the street, well, how much of the litter in our waterways is from plastic bags, they would give you a much higher percentage.
There have been lots of people concerned. I mean, plastic in waterways is a problem for wildlife. We know that. You learned some interesting perspective on the extent to which plastic bags compare with all the other plastic that might be floating around out there, which is not to say floating plastic is good, but it again, is maybe a smaller percentage of what's causing harm.
Right. So a couple things there. One, I'm in Washington, D.C., and we have a bag tax here, a 5-cent tax on plastic bags given out at retail establishments. And D.C. did a study in anticipation of considering that legislation in 2008, where they did, you know, sort of similar methodology to the Keep America Beautiful study and found that there are indeed plastic bags in the Anacostia River and in the waterways that feed it. And in fact, they sold the tax as, you know, ban the bag, save the river. But if you look at the study, which is, you know, published by the D.C. City Council, anyone can see it. Plastic bags are actually the third most prevalent form of litter. Bottles and cans and food wrappers are much more commonly found in D.C.'s waterways. So that's kind of anecdotal. More broadly, you very, very frequently hear this number when we're talking about marine life or seabirds. And you know, sea turtles are lovely. They are the charismatic megafauna of the oceans. They're panda bears floating past us, and everyone wants to save the sea turtles or at least do their best not to harm them. And you know, and I should say, just as a caveat here, I think everyone who wants these bans and who backs them is totally well-intentioned. I don't think this is some kind of conspiracy or something because we hate the manufacturers of plastic. I think it's mostly just a misunderstanding about the facts of the situation. So, for instance, the Blue Ocean Society, lots of other conservation groups, they say 1 million seabirds or 100,000 marine animals are harmed by plastic bags. If you dig down into the roots of that number, what you find is that it seems to be extrapolated from a study done in the early 80s off the coast of Newfoundland by the Canadian government that was actually a study of cast-off fishing gear and accidental catch. So it's just sort of this game of telephone where these numbers are out there, they get slightly misinterpreted, they get passed from person to person, and they actually tend to grow as they get repeated.
So there hasn't been, to your knowledge, did you look for another study that looked specifically at the impact of plastic bags on marine life?
I did. I looked pretty hard. And there doesn't seem to be anything that I would describe as a definitive or standard study. I did find people, experts, saying kind of, you know, anecdotally, that it's actually very, very rare for plastic bags that have been littered on land to make their way to sea to the extent that they could harm a sea turtle or you know, a seabird. That's actually just not where the plastic in oceans comes from, and that instead it is stuff like cast-off fishing gear or stuff that falls off of boats.
Catherine Mangu Ward is my guest. She's managing editor at Reason Magazine. She wrote the cover story for their October issue. It's called Plastic Bags Are Good For You. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, call 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or send me a tweet. My handle is @ChrisBoydThink.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can learn how to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, a customizable evening graduate program for working professionals. More at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Reason Magazine Managing Editor Catherine Mangu Ward. Her article, Plastic Bags Are Good For You, is the cover story in the October issue of Reason. If you'd like to be part of this conversation, maybe talk about your choices with regard to paper or plastic or reusable, give us a call. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. There have been all these studies about plastic fragments and objects being dangerous to wildlife. The Washington Post, you may have seen this, I think it was September 1st, estimated 90% of seabirds have eaten plastic, and they had these awful photographs of, you know, carcasses that have been cut open. It didn't look like there were a lot of plastic bags, but is it possible that they have ingested bag fragments and they just don't show up in these samples?
You know, of course it's possible. I think it always seems a little bit churlish, right, when you're looking at these horrible pictures of animals suffering, to like litigate what's in there. It's like, right. Oh, well, that's fishing gear and not a plastic bag. But, you know, I do think, you know, people want to do the right thing and they want to try and protect animals or do what's best for the environment. And we don't actually do anybody any favors by fudging the differences. You know, it's one thing to say, okay, overall plastic in, you know, in natural environments could, you know, is a serious concern. So I'm going to get this cotton tote and call it a day. When in fact, you know, if you're actually doing harm, you know, I think it's worth highlighting that.
Okay, full disclosure, I carry nylon reusable bags for most shopping, in part because otherwise at our house we end up with far more bags than we can recycle as like trash can liners. When the ban was in place, though, and we weren't getting even the occasional plastic bag, I was struck by the irony of having to go out and buy plastic bags for bathroom waste baskets.
Right, and that is something that, you know, is an easy thing to discount, even when you're trying to do the math on these bans. And you say, okay, well, you know, let's look at the reuse rates for the reusable bags. Let's look at the impact of the disposable bags. And you forget actually that a huge percentage of those what we think of as disposable bags, what are often referred to in the technical literature as disposable bags, are actually used twice bags. People use them to clean up after their pets. They use them to line trash cans. It's very hard to get precise information on that, but it seems like at least something like 70 or 80% of households reuse at least some of those disposable high-density polyethylene bags.
All right, I want to talk about some of the things we use to replace disposable plastic bags. These days, just about every grocery store you go to will sell you those sort of large, rectangular, shiny, crinkly bags with the handles. They're 99 cents or so. What are those made out of?
So the crinkly ones are polypropylene, which is a sort of totally separate technology from high-density polyethylene. Those bags are actually, there's another statistic you frequently see that talks about how many barrels of oil we could save if we all used reusable bags. And the most frequently cited number, the one that the New York Times has cited, is, you know, we use 12 million barrels of oil every year to make 100 billion plastic disposable bags. There's a couple things about that figure that you should know. One is that actually most of your disposable bags are not made with oil. They're made with gas. They're made with natural gas. Over the last 30 years, something like 3.5% of disposable plastic bags are made with oil. You know, you can still say, well, there's an imperative to conserve all kinds of fossil fuels, but, you know, there is a very different calculus that goes into place when we think about natural gas versus oil. So that's worth keeping in mind. Those polypropylene totes, though, the crinkly reusable ones, those are made with oil. And one thing that I found in my research is that in 2010, which is the year that I found the best figures for, something like 690,000 tons of bags were thrown away. Disposable grocery bags were thrown away. Of those, about 30,000 were retrieved and recycled. But about 680,000 tons of polypropylene bags were also thrown away, and none of those were recycled. So, in fact, in terms of landfill space in 2010, there were more of these reusable bags in our landfills than there were of these so-called disposable bags.
Wait, so we're throwing away the reusables. Why are they? Is that because they get torn? Do you have any idea why these things are getting tossed at a greater volume than the throwaway ones?
You know, it's worth noting here that we don't throw away more bags. We throw away more weight of bags, right? So one thing to think about there, it takes a lot of these little filmy disposable ones to equal the weight of one of these technically reusable bags. So there's that sort of calculus there. I mean, I don't know about you. These things seem to multiply in my house. I mean, even after I did this reporting for this piece, like, I'm a good yuppie. I live in Washington, D.C. I carry my little reusable totes around for lots of reasons, not least my fear of social censure and my desire to save 5 cents. But, but you know, you forget a bag, so you buy another one. You know, your local stores give them away for free. I find myself throwing away these reusables pretty often because otherwise my whole house would just be full of reusable bags.
So what about the ones that are not shiny and crinkly? They're kind of a they look woven or like a you know, they're sort of more matte in finish. Do you know what those bags are made of?
There's a bunch of different mixes on the market, and there's the ones that sort of look linen-like. Those the numbers on those, as far as I can tell, are kind of somewhere between the crinkly polypropylene ones and cotton. And cotton bags, it turns out, are a disaster in terms of an emissions footprint. You would have to reuse a polypropylene bag about 11 times to make it come out even in terms of, you know, per use emissions footprint of a high density polyethylene bag. But a cotton bag, you have to reuse 131 times. So if you bought one of those, this is not a plastic bag totes that you mentioned at the top of the hour, you better still be using that thing. And I think, again, we have this sort of sense of something that's more natural, or that it's somehow closer to the technologies that our ancestors used, and that it's therefore better for the environment. And this is a great example where that's just not true.
Another irony that has struck me is that, yeah, I like using my reusable bags, but it's really hard if you go to a conventional grocery store, as most of us do for convenience sake, on a regular basis. It's hard to reduce the volume of plastic that you carry home inside of whatever bag you have chosen.
Right. And that's something that doesn't show up in any of these studies, again, because it's so hard to quantify. But yeah, even if we're swapping out the sort of very, very outer layer of swaddling of all of our groceries, still we're taking home, you know, the styrofoam under the package of chicken, the saran wrap around it, the packaging around our string cheese that we put in our lunches, you know, whatever it is, everything is very packaged. Those are different kinds of plastic. So mostly that isn't the same raw material that goes into grocery bags. And in some ways, it's more difficult to recycle. But yeah, we live in a high plastic environment. And a lot of that is for very good reasons. The reason that so much plastic is present in our grocery store is to stop us from getting sick, in large part. Of course, some of it is to make it colorful and attractive and try and get you to buy it. But, you know, it's not as if the makers of foodstuffs would rather just throw everything in a big vat and say, stick your hands in there and grab it. They wrap it in plastic for a reason.
Yeah, and talk about getting sick. I mean, this is something that's easy to forget, that food used to make us sick all the time, even if we bought it from a store, because it was contaminated. Plastic, for better or for worse, does sort of seal off the product from the outside world.
Right. I mean, a huge part of getting sick from food is contamination. So it's when food that has a problem touches all the other food that you or other people eat, and then that food has a similar problem. Usually it's coliform bacteria, but there are lots of other foodborne illnesses, obviously. So I actually had a little internal tension when I was working on this piece about the extent to which I should harp on this message that reusable bags can make us sick. Because, you know, I sort of hate that school of journalism, right? You know, your toaster is killing you. Your coffee pot is giving you cancer.
Film
your
at 11,
apples are
right.
Murdering your children. So, you know, I tried to look into this sort of data about, well, on the surface of it, it actually does sound pretty plausible, right? And I think we've all done this and then grossed out by it, which is you put a package of chicken in your reusable bag. You take the chicken out, you put it in your fridge, then you jumble up the reusable bag in the bottom of your car and it sits there for a couple of weeks, and then you take that same bag and you put celery in it. and then you eat the celery. Yeah. And if you think about it for a minute, you're like, oh, God, I have to go home and wash all my bags right now. But, you know, in fact, there is some evidence that people do get sick from exactly that behavior. There was, I think, a soccer team in 2010 that was the subject of a study in an academic journal. You do find coliform bacteria in virtually everyone's grocery bags. If you do a random survey of shoppers on the street, you take their bags. People have done this. You know, you find coliform bacteria in half of the reusable shopping bags. Only 18% of shoppers report washing their bags regularly. So it does kind of on the surface of it seem as if we are going back, at least in part, to the era when you went to the butcher and wrapped your meat in dirty canvas.
800-9... Please, let's not go back quite that far. 800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Aaron in Mansfield. Hi, Aaron.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure.
I was wondering about the... You were talking about the impact of saving the bacteria from chicken and plastics. I was wondering about some of the additives used in plastics, such as BPA and whatnot, if they have impact on our health, as well as I saw in your article you talked about comparison of plastic bags versus like cotton bags. Any thoughts about usage of hemp instead? Thanks
for calling.
So I work for a libertarian magazine, so obviously I'm in favor of putting hemp in everything all the time, everywhere. That's probably more of an aesthetic judgment, though, than a scientifically backed one. I am in general, you know, for the same reason that I was hesitant to fearmonger about cloth bags, I am pretty skeptical of the claims that plastics in contact with our food have negative health consequences. But that said, you know, again, there's this sort of temptation to the symbolic act. Oh, well, I'll put a canvas bag around the rest of my groceries and that will somehow give them a halo of health or purify them or make my experience more natural, when in fact the plastic is still kind of everywhere in our environment and certainly used in the processing of food as well as the packaging that comes with the product itself.
What did you learn, Catherine, about the ability, how feasible is it to recycle plastic bags and get, you know, a decent percentage out of whatever the byproduct is?
So that's actually an interesting, it's sort of a moving target. So there was a period sort of at the peak plastic of the paper or plastic era. You probably remember this. A lot of your listeners probably remember this. There used to be little kiosks at the grocery store mm-hmm. where you could stuff your spare plastic bags in and they would take them away and recycle them. With many kinds of recycling, the make or break is how easy it is to sort out one kind of plastic or other recyclable from a general recycling stream. So again, here in Washington, we put all of our recycling in one bin, and then the city is responsible for sorting that out. It's very hard to sort out plastic bags and get good quality plastic. So kind of paradoxically, as we've been discouraged from using high-density polyethylene bags, that has also made it harder to get enough good, high-quality bag trash to make recycling worthwhile. The second component of that is the reduced cost of oil. When oil or natural gas are cheap, it means that it's less worthwhile to recycle. So it's really just an economic question.
Did you learn, I'm always fascinated about the sorting that takes place at municipal recycling facilities. Is that mostly done by human eyes or are there machines that try to shake things out and separate the metal from the plastic from the glass?
You know, I did look into that a little bit. There was actually a wonderful segment on Planet Money on NPR about this in April that did a really good job of capturing how the system works. The answer is machines do it, but they aren't great at it, in particular because the bags themselves can be very hard to, you can be very hard to tell between the different types of bags, even though they are different materials, even for the machines. Some recyclers have actually taken to hiring a human to stand on the line and pick through the trash to improve the quality of what winds up in the kind of recycling pool. It's highly mechanized, but again, the effort that goes into producing high quality recyclables has everything to do with the market for those recyclables and And when the raw materials are cheap, it simply makes less sense to recycle.
So it has to be worth the money for somebody to go to the trouble, which is one reason that a lot of styrofoam, right, could be recycled but doesn't get recycled. It ends up in a landfill even if you try to recycle it.
That's right. That's true of many, many, you know, theoretically recyclable goods are not, in fact, recycled because it's not worth it from the economic perspective. And I think the economics aren't irrelevant, right? You know, the temptation is to say conserving resources is the ultimate importance. You know, to choose not to recycle this shows the failure of the market for serving environmental ends. I would actually say that it's, you know, the invention of the plastic bag, of the disposable plastic bag, shows a great way that kind of markets and environmental ends dovetail. And plastic bags use so little in terms of raw resources, and particularly because people do tend to reuse them at least once, they're even more efficient from that perspective. So, again, I would just caution against the kind of symbolic, we don't want to use plastic and we have to recycle it if we do, and to think harder about what the real economics of the thing are.
Did you talk to folks within the plastics industry for this piece?
I did a little bit. I spoke with the industry association types. I actually got a fair amount of contact from them after the piece was published, like thanks to the propaganda lady. This is frequently a joke among reporters. You know, you always get these letters saying, it's clear you're in the pay of big plastic. You know, why else would you have written this? My temptation is to always reply back like, yeah, if you know anyone in big plastic who wants to write me a check, that would be great. But sadly, that is not the case. The piece really came out of kind of a genuine impulse toward inquiry. And there were some people in the plastics industry who liked it.
My guest is Catherine Mangue Ward. She's managing editor of Reason Magazine and wrote its cover story for the October issue called Plastic Bags Are Good For You. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can learn how to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, specializing in human rights, organizational dynamics, and more. Details at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Reason Magazine managing editor Catherine Mangue Ward, who wrote a piece for the cover of the October issue called Plastic Bags Are Good For You. That's what we're talking about this hour. You can join the conversation at 800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Let's go on the phone now to Kim in Dallas. Hi, Kim.
Hi.
Hi. Go right ahead, please.
Okay, well, I just wanted to make some comments regarding styrofoam you mentioned. I'm recently living like two lives, one in DFW and one in southeastern Oklahoma. And I was very impressed when I got there because this is a small community, a lot of rural areas. Probably the worst thing there as far as trash on the side of the road was styrofoam. And about a year ago, the Choctaw Nation Indian Tribe got a federal grant to start a recycling program, and they cover a couple of counties, and they have dumpsters at the grocery store, and they have dumpsters at the local colleges, and you can actually recycle styrofoam. So there was this comment about some things aren't recycled, that there's not a market. I can't believe if there's a market in a very small community and that people are participating in recycling styrofoam, that, you know, this couldn't be done other places. And I'm to the point now where I save all my styrofoam and rinse it out in Dallas-Fort Worth and take it when I go up there so that I can recycle it.
Well, great. Thank you so much for your call, Kim. I appreciate the perspective. Good to know that somebody is, in fact, recycling styrofoam. Is there anything that you want to comment on there, Catherine?
I guess I would just say that the key part of that story was the federal grant that makes it possible. Again, you know, if this is something that, you know, we decide we want to subsidize, that's sort of a question for the electorate and for our legislators. But the fact that that styrofoam recycling program exists doesn't demonstrate the existence of a sort of viable market for styrofoam recycling. It demonstrates the willingness of the sort of political sector to subsidize that act.
We have an email here from Sandra who says, I've heard that plastic has the quality of being photodegradable. When it sits in the sun, it breaks up into tiny little pieces, but never biodegradable, leaving thousands of chemicals in our environment that are nearly impossible to clean up. What do you know about this phenomenon?
I guess my short answer is not very much. I'm unfortunately not really a subject matter expert here, just a journalist who researched it for a piece. One thing I do know is that there have been some very sort of well-funded, serious commercial efforts to come up with truly biodegradable plastic bags, because that does seem like a solution, right? Okay, if this object is everywhere and we are concerned about its impact, let's design a version that is more susceptible to the kind of natural dispersal that we would like to see. And those bags actually wind up having an even bigger emissions footprint than the traditional polyethylene bags.
Really?
Because they're so hard to produce, because the sort of amount of energy that it takes to produce the type of bag. It's true they don't take up landfill space, but in the meantime, you've contributed to global warming if you want to do the math on that.
There's also the issue of how much things cost, which, you know, the whole paper or plastic debate was also influenced by the fact that, as you mentioned, you know, plastic bags initially came in at 11% cheaper. They might even be cheaper still now than paper bags. And whether we want to admit it or not, people make choices, businesses make choices based on what an asset is going to cost them.
That's right. And I don't think that we should imagine for a minute that substituting out reusable bags or other technologies doesn't have a cost. I mean, I think there's this sort of vague notion that people have, like, oh, the grocery stores can take it out of their profits or something like that. But in fact, that's not what they do. That's really not how businesses work. The prices still do get passed on to customers. Again, it's a very, very small cost. The reason that stores were giving these things away in the first place is because they were mind-blowingly cheap. But in D.C., for instance, the 5-cent bag tax, one reason that they were able to get that tax through is because they essentially gave the merchants a cut. They said, we'll pay you to not use these bags, even though it makes good sense for your bottom line. But when it's an outright ban, you don't even get that compromise. So stores wind up making it up somewhere else.
Let's go next on the phone to Harvey in Levon. Hi, Harvey.
How are y'all doing?
Very well, thanks.
Talking about my favorite topic.
All right.
Ubuntu. UBUNTUBLOX. Ubuntu blocks. We take 25 to 30 single-purpose plastic bags and about a grocery 13-gallon grocery trash bag full of crushed-up styrofoam, hand-done, and we make a block. We build houses with it. We're going to be doing some of this fall with the Girl Scouts at their place in South Dallas. It's an amazing thing. The blocks are manual machines. They perfect use for styrofoam. Ends up with a wall with about an R value of 40. SMU worked with us. We built a house and had it tested on a commercial lab. 8.2 earthquake. We were certified with cosmetic damage only. It's an amazing thing, and it's a great use for styrofoam without using any carbon footprint to dispose of it.
Well, thank you so much for your call, Harvey. A great reminder that there may be uses other than simply sending things off to a recycling plant that make further use of materials that otherwise get thrown away. 800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Jim in Dallas. Hey, Jim.
Yes, the bag itself has no body to it, so it doesn't stand up like a paper bag. So they had to figure out a way to put them on a stand and then to separate them. And they came up with this very ingenious little thing called a first side first cutter. So you could pull the front of the bag out, fill it up, and then yank it, and the second bag would come out. and you could load it up. And if you hadn't had that, they would never have used plastic bags.
Interesting. I guess Catherine, do you know anything about the design other than the guy who had the great idea of coming up with a way to give them handles easily?
Yeah, there's actually a whole great, I think, story of innovation to be told there. Your caller is absolutely right that that was one of the challenges that had to be overcome. Those bags actually are referred to in the industry typically as T-shirt bags for reasons that are a little bit lost to history, but maybe because when you lay them out flat, the way the packs look, they kind of look like a T-shirt with the handles flapped down like the sleeves. But yeah, there's this sort of this fascinating thing that happens when you say we can achieve this same function for much cheaper. We just have a couple of little technical things we need to overcome. You know, DuPont or in the Swedish company Celloplast or these sort of big corporations, they can throw a lot at figuring out how to make that product, you know, work efficiently and be appealing for their customers who are the retailers.
To the extent that, you know, plastic bags sometimes are useful and necessary, but sometimes unnecessary, did you look at all into how much suggestion would work to keep people from taking a bag when they don't absolutely need one? Like if I go to the store and I buy one small item that fits in my purse or easily in my hand, I don't need a bag. I typically say, please don't give me a bag. But if I were asked, reminded every time, do you need a bag? I might say no and save a bag that way.
Yeah, I think that that's actually been happening as a sort of accidental experiment in places where there are bag taxes as opposed to bans, right? Because it does ask people essentially to make that calculation every time they buy something. Is it worth 5 cents for me to have something to carry this in? Of course, there are also ways around that. There is, you know, in many cities where there's a plastic bag tax, there are still, you know, paper bags are not subject to it. So that may be the out. But I guess I think people frequently undervalue their own time and they frequently undervalue transaction costs. So while on the surface of it, it seems like, yeah, why not pause and say, do you need a bag? And then you say, no, thank you, I don't need a bag. And you put it in your purse and resources have been saved. But the resources that was spent there was time. And that's very hard to kind of see. It's very hard to aggregate. But that's the reason that so many of these convenience technologies evolve in the first place, is because time is very valuable in the modern world. And just saying, here, take a bag, do whatever you want with it, paradoxically might be the best use of resources.
Back to the phones now. We have Judy on the line in Grand Prairie. Hey, Judy.
Hi. I have been wondering lately about this very subject, so I'm glad you have it today. But I have not bought garbage bags in years. And I don't carry the cloth ones. I just grab a few bags out of the little recycling bin at the store and just use those. They look clean enough. And when I walk the dogs, about 3 times a week, John and I eat fast food. So we have these little cups with the plastic top in the hole. And I use those for the dogs' stuff. And they've got the little hole at the top, and if I run across nails and screws in the street, I put them through the little hole. So that way the garbage collectors don't, you know, when they pick up a bag, they don't have to worry about the nails poking them because they're in there with my dog, Super Scooper. But no, and I pick up trash when I walk through the neighborhood, and not just I have the Super Scooper there, and I pick up trash, so I find them very handy, and I was just wondering, was I hurting the environment? So I'm glad to find out that I'm not.
Thank you for your call, Judy. Those are some great little life hacks. The idea of, like, if you have nails or screws or something, you can put them in a cup that, you know, you may have received from somewhere, a paper cup or a plastic cup. It's a good idea. 800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Cassandra in Dallas. Hey, Cassandra.
Hi, yes, I was just wondering, I have, you know, a friend that works at a food store that, you know, promotes, like, all natural, you know, organic foods, and I don't want to give any names, but he...
You don't need to.
He said that, you know, they have the Center for Recycling Plastic Bags, and that most of the time that they just throw them in the trash can and actually don't recycle them, and I've heard that as well from friends who work in cell phone stores, and I was just kind of wondering if, you know, like where they end up at or what kind of impact that actually has. And if, you know, there are a lot of big grocery stores doing that, and if, you know, there's any law that kind of like prohibits that or anything like that.
Wow. Do you know anything about that, Catherine?
Yeah, so that's actually very common with all kinds of recycling, and it's not just stores that do it, it's cities. When they ask us to, you know, rinse out our containers and separate them and put them into the various bags and boxes and bins, very, very often, I think much more often than people would like to contemplate, those recyclables are then going into the trash. Now, in the case of your friend, I don't know whether that's a sort of order from on high, because at the moment, the economics of plastic bag recycling aren't there. But, it may be that in the past they have given those to recycling companies. In the future, they may do so again. And right now, the price just isn't right. So they chuck them. Maybe it's just that the store's employees are lazy, in which case, that's a sort of human error. But it's very, very common for recyclables to wind up in landfills for the reason that it's just not economically feasible to go through the whole recycling process.
So I did note that on the page facing your article in Reason Magazine, there's an ad selling Reason Magazine merchandise. And in the left-hand column, there is a cotton tote bag. And, you know, this is an NPR affiliate, so we, too, like to give people tote bags to say thank you. But did you happen to notice that when you looked at the layout of the piece?
You know, we actually did, and we decided to leave it because we were amused just as you were.
You mentioned that you still, you know, you wrote this piece, you still sometimes carry reusable bags with you because of the tax. I have to imagine that the folks at Reason Magazine are not crazy about a bag tax, but is that an effective way? I mean, you give people then the option to do whatever they want, but they have to pay for it if they want to take a plastic bag.
Right. So I think a tax is virtually always preferable to an outright ban in situations like this, precisely because of what you just said, because there's always going to be someone who really, really, really needs a bag. And, you know, to give them the opportunity to pay for it in a sort of semi-convenient way, at least, is still better. I mean, my thought is always, it's great that people want to make good choices. It even makes sense for stores to, incentivize the choices that they prefer. But when it comes right down to it, I just don't like, and I think a lot of people don't like, the idea of legislators in a capital city somewhere, be it Washington, D.C. or their state capital or their city council, saying, nope, we decided for all of you, no more bags. That's our rule. Because that really doesn't take into account people like, two callers ago, this woman who's a gold star environmentalist. Her use of plastic bags like brought a tear to my eye because it was so efficient and perfect. And that gal exists. So, why would we use an outright ban as a blunt instrument when she's really making the best of her resources?
Catherine Mangu Ward is managing editor of Reason Magazine. Her article, Plastic Bags Are Good For You, is the cover story in the October issue. Catherine, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.